A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about witness protection programs, the ones Hollywood loves to dramatize with the dramatic new identity in an envelope moment. But the real question is, what these programs actually look like across different countries, how they function, and what happens when you're testifying against organized crime, and the state is the only thing standing between you and a bullet. Which, honestly, is a lot messier than anything you'd see in a movie.
It really is. And the timing on this is interesting because just this month, the UK's National Crime Agency reported a 40% increase in witness intimidation cases linked to County Line's drug operations. So these programs are under more pressure than they've been in years, and most of them were never built for the volume they're dealing with now.
That's not a blip. That's a structural shift. So before we get into the gritty details of how these programs actually work, let's set the stage with what witness protection is supposed to do. Because the Hollywood version is basically the witness relocation program from My Blue Heaven,
which is a comedy about a mobster in witness protection, starring Steve Martin, and it's loosely based on the Henry Hill story.
Of course you know that.
Here's the thing. Witness protection isn't just relocation. It's a comprehensive package. You've got three pillars: physical security, which is the obvious one, relocation, surveillance, sometimes armed protection. Then legal protection, which covers things like testimony shielding, contempt powers to compel testimony, and procedural safeguards in court. And then the one nobody talks about, social reintegration. New identity, employment assistance, psychological counseling, financial support while you get on your feet. It's not witness protection, it's witness reconstruction.
Which sounds like a home renovation show with much higher stakes.
This old house, but the old house is your entire life, and if the renovation fails, you die.
So, what's the origin story here? Because witness protection as a formal concept isn't that old.
It's really not. The U.S. Marshal Service Witness Security Program, WITSEC, was founded in 1971 under the Organized Crime Control Act. But the thing that made it necessary happened almost a decade earlier. In 1963, a Genovese crime family soldier named Joe Valachi became the first Mafia member to publicly testify before Congress about the inner workings of organized crime. Before Valachi, the FBI officially denied the Mafia even existed. Edgar Hoover called it a myth.
Wait, Hoover denied the Mafia existed?
Publicly and repeatedly. Partly because he didn't want to admit there was a national crime syndicate operating on his watch, and partly because mob-controlled unions were politically useful to him. But Valachi's testimony blew that fiction apart, and suddenly you had this problem. How do you get people to testify against organized crime when testifying is a death sentence? The answer was WITSEC.
The entire program is basically the government admitting that its own denial created a situation where witnesses were guaranteed to be killed unless they built an entirely new apparatus to protect them. That's a very tidy bureaucratic circle.
The apparatus they built is genuinely impressive in scope. Let me walk through how the U.S. program actually works operationally, because it's the model everyone else either copies or reacts against. The U.S. Marshal Service runs WITSEC with an annual budget of about $100 million, based on 2025 figures. At any given time, they're protecting roughly 800 to 900 witnesses and about 1,600 family members. Since 1971, they've protected over 19,000 witnesses and 28,000 family members.
That's a small city's worth of people who don't exist anymore.
And the admission criteria are surprisingly strict. You can't just be a witness in any case. It has to involve organized crime, drug trafficking, terrorism, or violent felonies where the threat is imminent and corroborated by intelligence, not just the witness saying they're scared. You also have to pass a psychological evaluation and a polygraph.
The polygraph part is fascinating. What are they screening for?
They're screening for whether the witness is actually who they say they are, whether they're a plant, whether they have undisclosed criminal history that would make them a liability. but it's also a test of compliance. The Marshal Service wants to know, can this person follow instructions under pressure? Because if you can't sit still for a polygraph, you're not going to survive a decade of living under a false identity without slipping up.
Slipping up is not a slap on the wrist. I read about a case from 2019. A Chicago mob witness was expelled from the program because he used a credit card in his old name to buy a plane ticket. One credit card swipe, and he was out.
That's the thing most people don't understand about WITSEC. It's not a right, it's a contract, and the Marshal Service can terminate you for non-compliance. According to a 2023 DOJ Inspector General report, about 17% of WITCC participants are terminated for violating program rules. The most common violations are contacting old associates, returning to their original city, or committing new crimes.
17% is high for something where the penalty for failure is death.
It is, but it reflects the fundamental tension at the heart of these programs. You're asking people to sever every human connection they've ever had. Family who aren't in the program, friends, co-workers, their neighborhood, their favorite coffee shop, everything. And then you're asking them to build a new life from scratch in a place they've never been, with a name they didn't choose, doing work they may not be qualified for. The psychological pressure is immense.
There's a line from a witness I read about. He said he'd rather have done another 5 years in prison than live under witness protection, because at least in prison he knew who he was.
That's not uncommon. And it brings us to the case study everyone knows, Sammy the Bull Gravano. He was John Gotti's underboss in the Gambino crime family, and his testimony in the early 90s was instrumental in dismantling the family's leadership. He entered WITSEC in 1994, was relocated to Arizona, given a new identity. And by 2000, he was arrested for running an ecstasy ring in Phoenix, under his new identity, using his WITSEC cover business as a front.
The guy who was supposed to be the poster child for witness protection became the poster child for why it fails.
The failure mode is instructive. Gravano didn't just violate the rules, he used the infrastructure of his new identity to build a new criminal enterprise. He got plastic surgery, which the program paid for, and then used his unrecognizable appearance to recruit young people into drug trafficking. He was sentenced to 20 years. But here's the detail that keeps program administrators up at night. Gravano later said he found running an ecstasy ring in Arizona easier than being a mobster in New York, because nobody in his new life had any reason to suspect him.
Like adopting a feral cat and discovering it's actually a mountain lion.
That's exactly the metaphor. And it points to a structural problem. The program gives you a clean slate, but it doesn't give you a new moral compass. If you were a career criminal before entering WITSEC, you're still a career criminal after... you just have better cover now.
The program is simultaneously the most effective tool for prosecuting organized crime and a system that can inadvertently incubate new criminal networks in places that never had them before.
That's just the U.S., but the U.S. model isn't the only game in town. Let's look at how other countries handle the same problem with very different approaches, because the contrasts reveal a lot about what works and what doesn't.
Before you jump into that, one thing about the US program I want to flag. You mentioned the budget is about $100 million. That sounds like a lot until you realize that's roughly what the Pentagon spends on. I don't know. Air conditioning in Afghanistan in a given year.
The comparison the statisticians actually use is golf course maintenance on military bases, which is about $140 million annually. WITC is not expensive by federal budget standards. A single F-35 fighter jet costs about $80 million, so the entire witness protection program for the United States costs slightly more than one stealth aircraft.
Which is either a testament to efficiency or a sign that it's under-resourced.
All right, international comparisons. The UK established its Protected Person Service, the PPS, in 2013. Before that, witness protection was handled by regional police forces on an ad hoc basis, which meant the quality of your protection depended entirely on which constabulary you happened to be dealing with. The PPS centralizes that, protecting about 300 witnesses annually with a budget of £15 million.
Which is roughly 1/6 the size of the US program per capita, if I'm doing the math right.
And the UK approach is philosophically different from the American one. The UK program does not automatically change your identity. Witnesses are relocated within the UK but retain their original name unless the threat is extreme. Instead of identity replacement, they use what they call lifestyle changes. New job, new routine, new social circles, but you're still legally the same person.
That seems both more humane and more fragile. If you keep your name, how hard is it for someone to find you?
That's the trade-off. The UK argument is that full identity change is psychologically devastating and creates a class of people who can never fully participate in society. They can't build credit, they can't maintain professional licenses, their educational credentials become useless. The UK system says, we'll move you, we'll protect you, but you get to stay you. The counter-argument is that in the age of digital surveillance, staying you means staying findable. If you keep your name and your national insurance number, a determined adversary with access to commercial databases can probably locate you. And organized crime groups increasingly have access to those databases.
Which connects to something we should talk about later, the digital identity problem. But keep going.
Germany takes yet another approach. Their program, the Jugendschutz program, is run by the Federal Criminal Police Office, the BKA. They offer identity change only for witnesses against organized crime or terrorism. But the distinctive German innovation is the Witness Protection Agreement. It's a legally binding contract that specifies obligations on both sides. The state promises specific protections, the witness promises specific behaviors. And if either side breaches the contract, there are legal remedies.
It's not just an administrative arrangement. It's a contract enforceable in court.
Which sounds great in theory, but in practice it creates problems. In 2024, a German witness sued the BKA for inadequate protection after being identified by a Turkish organized crime group. How was he identified? A leaked police database. The very institution that was supposed to protect him became the vector for his exposure.
That's the nightmare scenario. You enter the program, you follow all the rules, and then the state's own incompetence gets you killed.
It's not an isolated case. In 2025, a German witness protection database containing 1,200 identities was leaked on a dark web forum. 1,200 people whose entire safety depended on the state keeping a secret, and the state couldn't keep the secret.
Was anyone harmed?
The BKA hasn't released specifics, but they acknowledged the breach and relocated affected witnesses. The problem is, once your identity is on a dark web forum, relocation doesn't solve the problem. Your face, your name, your history are out there permanently.
This is the thing about witness protection that feels almost quaint in the modern era. The program was designed for a world where if you move someone to Arizona and gave them a new name, nobody in Arizona had any way of knowing who they used to be. That world doesn't exist anymore.
Yet Italy's program, which is the oldest in Europe, founded in 1991, has been remarkably effective despite operating in the same digital environment. The Central Commission for Witness Protection runs it, and it's built around the pentito system. Pentito meaning someone who repents, a mafia member who turns state's evidence.
The pentito system is the thing that took down the Sicilian mafia, right?
It's the thing that took down the Sicilian mafia, the Camorra, and increasingly the 'Ndrangheta. Since 1992, testimony from protected witnesses has led to over 1,000 convictions. In 2023, Italy convicted 46 Ndrangheta members based on testimony from 12 protected witnesses, the largest mafia trial in 30 years. The conviction rate for cases where protected witnesses testify is 98%.
98% is not a number you see in criminal justice very often. What makes the Italian program different?
First, the financial support is more generous and more structured. Protected witnesses receive a monthly stipend of up to 2,500 euros, and they're allowed to continue working in their original profession if possible. A mafia accountant can be a civilian accountant in a new city. A mafia truck driver can be a civilian truck driver. The program doesn't force you to abandon your skills.
It's less disruptive to identity.
The second thing is cultural. In Italy, turning state's evidence isn't just a legal transaction, it's framed as moral redemption. The pentito is someone who has seen the error of their ways and is making amends. That narrative makes it easier for witnesses to psychologically reconcile with their new life, and it makes it harder for their former associates to dismiss them as mere traitors.
The Catholic confession model applied to organized crime.
And it works. But Italy also has a feature that most other programs don't. Witnesses can't just disappear. They have to testify. The protection is contingent on cooperation, and the cooperation has to be complete and truthful. If you hold back information, the deal is off.
Which brings us to Canada, which apparently has the highest voluntary exit rate of any comparable program.
The RCMP's Witness Protection Program has protected about 2,000 witnesses since 1996, and 12% of them have requested termination of protection and return to their original identity. That's unique. Most programs don't allow voluntary exit at all. In the U.S., once you're in WITSEC, you're in for life unless you're terminated for cause. Canada lets you say, I changed my mind, I want to go back.
What happens to the 12% who go back?
The RCMP doesn't publish outcomes, but anecdotally, some of them return to criminal activity, some reconcile with their former associates, and some just couldn't handle the isolation and decided the risk was worth it. But the fact that the option exists changes the psychology of the program. In the US, entering WITSEC feels like a one-way door. In Canada, it's more like a door that's very heavy but technically swings both ways.
Does that make witnesses more willing to enter the program, knowing they can leave?
The data suggests yes, but it also creates a moral hazard. If you know you can exit, you might be less committed to making the new life work. You might treat protection as temporary rather than permanent, which affects your behavior and your psychological adjustment.
Across these four countries, US, UK, Germany, Italy, you've got a spectrum. On one end, the US model, complete identity erasure, permanent, high control, high psychological cost. On the other end, the UK model, keep your identity, change your lifestyle, lower psychological cost, but probably lower security. Italy in the middle with identity change, plus professional continuity, and Germany with the contractual approach. Canada doing its own thing with the exit option.
The uncomfortable question none of them have fully answered is whether any of these models can survive the digital age. Let me give you a concrete example. Clearview, AI, the facial recognition company that scraped billions of images from social media, is now being used by organized crime groups. There are documented cases of criminal organizations using facial recognition to identify witnesses who thought they'd disappeared.
The mob has better surveillance tech than the programs designed to protect people from the mob.
In some cases, yes. And the U.S. Marshal Service knows this. As of January this year, they've started piloting what they call digital identity scrubbing services. It's not enough to change someone's social security number and driver's license anymore. You have to go through every social media platform, every data broker, every public record database, and systematically remove or falsify their digital footprint.
Which sounds like trying to remove a specific drop of water from the ocean.
It's enormously difficult, and it's a race against time, because AI-generated deepfakes and biometric tracking are getting cheaper and more accessible every year. The 2025 breach of that German database is just a preview. Imagine an organized crime group using AI to generate synthetic images of a protected witness from old photos, then running those through commercial facial recognition APIs to find current matches. That's not science fiction. The technology exists today.
What does all this mean for someone who might actually need witness protection, or for policymakers thinking about reform?
A few things. First, witness protection is not a set-it-and-forget-it solution. It requires continuous psychological support and monitoring. The U.S. program now mandates quarterly mental health check-ins, after a 2022 study found that 34% of protected witnesses showed PTSD symptoms. That's a significant policy shift. They're acknowledging that the psychological cost is not just a side effect, it's a core program risk.
34% with PTSD symptoms. That's higher than combat veterans from some conflicts.
It makes sense when you think about it. A combat veteran comes home to a society that honors their service. A protected witness comes home to a society that doesn't know they exist, and they can never tell anyone what they did or why. The isolation is total.
Second actionable insight?
The most effective programs, Italy and the U.S., are the ones that treat witness protection as a long-term partnership with legal teeth, not just a relocation service. The Italian conviction rate speaks for itself. But effectiveness requires resources, and most programs are underfunded relative to the threat.
For the listener who's thinking, well, this is fascinating, but I'll never need witness protection, what should they actually know?
One, if you ever do find yourself in a position to need witness protection, unlikely but not impossible, know that the decision to enter a program is irreversible in most jurisdictions. You cannot unring that bell. In the U.S., U.K., Germany, and Italy, once you're in, you're in. Consult a lawyer who specializes in criminal procedure before agreeing to testify. Don't make that decision based on what a detective tells you in an interview room.
Because the detective's job is to get your testimony, not to manage the next 20 years of your life.
The second thing is that witness protection is a public good that affects everyone, whether you ever need it or not. Without protected witnesses, organized crime prosecutions collapse. The reason we know how the mafia works, how drug cartels operate, how terrorist cells organize, a lot of that knowledge comes from people who testified under protection. If the programs fail, the knowledge dries up, and organized crime gets harder to prosecute.
Which brings us to the big question that keeps law enforcement up at night. Can witness protection survive the digital age?
The EU seems to think the answer is more coordination. In March of this year, they proposed a unified witness protection framework that would allow cross-border relocation within the Schengen area. Right now, a witness protected in Germany can't easily be relocated to France because the programs don't interoperate. The framework would change that.
Privacy advocates are pushing back?
They are, and their concern is worth taking seriously. A unified framework means a unified database. A unified database means a single point of failure. If that database gets breached, and databases get breached, every protected witness in Europe is exposed simultaneously. The advocates are saying, before you build a pan-European witness database, make sure you can actually secure it.
Which, given the German breach last year, is not a confidence-inspiring proposition.
And there's a deeper tension here that nobody's really resolved. Witness protection requires the state to create and maintain false identities. That's a power that can be abused. The same infrastructure that gives a mob witness a new driver's license could give a government agent a false identity for less legitimate purposes. The safeguards against abuse are mostly procedural, not structural.
The program that protects democracy from organized crime is itself a potential threat to democratic accountability.
That's the paradox, and it's why the programs are deliberately kept small and obscure. WICC doesn't want publicity. The UKPPS doesn't give interviews. These programs work best when nobody knows they exist, which is also why they're so hard to reform when they fail.
So, to pull this together, witness protection is a multi-jurisdictional patchwork of programs that share a common goal but diverge dramatically in philosophy and execution. The US goes for total identity erasure, the UK for lifestyle modification, Germany for legal contracts, Italy for moral redemption with professional continuity, Canada for the exit option. They all face the same existential threat from digital surveillance and facial recognition. They're all underfunded relative to the threat, and they're all operating on a model that was designed for a pre-internet world.
Yet they remain essential. The Italian conviction numbers alone make the case. Without protected witnesses, the 'Ndrangheta trial last year doesn't happen. 46 convictions don't happen. The deterrent effect evaporates. So the question isn't whether to have witness protection, it's how to modernize it before the digital environment makes it obsolete.
One thing I keep coming back to. You mentioned that about 5% of protected witnesses are killed or seriously harmed while in the program, according to that 2024 study in the Journal of Criminology. That's 1 in 20.
That's the number for witnesses who are actively being protected. The number for witnesses who refuse protection and testify anyway is almost certainly higher, though the data is hard to gather because those cases often aren't tracked systematically.
If you're a witness and you're offered protection, the math is about a 95% chance of survival with the program versus some unknown but significantly lower probability without it. That's a grim calculus, but it's also a clear one.
It's why, despite all the failures and breaches and psychological costs, people keep entering these programs. Because the alternative is worse.
If there's one thing a listener should take away from this, it's that witness protection is not a magic shield. It's a high-stakes bureaucratic arrangement that works most of the time, fails catastrophically some of the time, and is increasingly vulnerable to technologies that didn't exist when the programs were designed.
If you ever find yourself in the position of needing it, lawyer up before you sign anything.
Which is probably good advice for most interactions with the federal government, now that I think about it. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1953, a team of Belgian geologists surveying Lake Tanganyika discovered that a German-made echo sounder from 1911, abandoned at a mission station for 40 years, still functioned perfectly when powered by hand-cranked batteries. The device was subsequently used to produce the first complete bathymetric map of the lake's northern basin, revealing underwater valleys twice as deep as anyone had predicted.
An echo sounder from before World War I, still mapping lake floors in the 1950s. That's either a testament to German engineering, or a very patient lake.
I love the detail that it was hand-cranked, like the lake was just waiting for someone to come back and finish the job.
And that brings us to the open question I think we should leave listeners with. The EU's proposed Unified Witness Protection Framework is either going to be the thing that saves these programs from digital obsolescence, or the thing that creates the single biggest target for hackers in European law enforcement history. There's not really a middle ground.
The clock is ticking. Deepfake technology is improving faster than government procurement cycles can adapt. The U.S. Marshals Service's digital identity scrubbing pilot is a start, but it's reactive. It's trying to clean up a digital footprint that shouldn't have been created in the first place. The real solution is probably something more fundamental, like legal restrictions on commercial data brokerage that make it harder to build surveillance profiles on anyone, protected witness or not.
Which is a much bigger conversation about privacy law that we should probably tackle in another episode. For now, if you want to dig deeper, we put links in the show notes to the US Marshal Service's public FAQ on WICEC and the UK Protected Persons Service Annual Report. And if you found this episode valuable, rate us on your podcast app and share it with one friend who loves crime documentaries.
This has been My Weird Props. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Corn. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Frumingtop, and we'll catch you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Props, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird props, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird props, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.